From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. W.S. Merwin once described poetry as using language to say the unsayable. On today's Fresh Air, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet reads from his new collection of poems and talks with us about his life. Also today, I speak with composer William Balcom. He's best known for his renditions of American popular song with his wife Joan Morris, but he just won a Pulitzer Prize for his own compositions. Singer Susanna McCorkle continues her tribute to composer Irving Berlin with a couple of songs from Annie Get Your Gun. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the Broadway play M. Butterfly. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Stephen Spender once wrote this about my guest poet W.S. Merwin. He wrote, "It is as though things write their own poems through Merwin. At their best, they are poems of total attention, and as such they protest against our world of total distraction." Merwin has been honored with the Pulitzer Prize for his poetry, and he won an award from PEN, the International Writers' Organization, for his translations. W.S. Merwin grew up in an area of Pennsylvania that has since been strip-mined. He's written many poems about the beauty of the natural world and the consequences of man's desecration of it. He now lives with his wife in Hawaii. Merwin has a new book of poems titled The Rain in the Trees. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him to read a poem, but this one's not about nature. It's about love and memory and having entered the world before the one you love.
Being early. When you were born, I was a small child in a city, and even if somebody had brought me news of you, I would not have believed them. Already I had seen an ape chained in the sun with a bucket of water. I had heard bells calling from wooden towers, stone towers, brick towers. I had seen blood coming through bandages on a hand holding candy and a shadow shining on green water where tall birds were standing, and I knew the notes of streetcars and the smells of three rivers and could have told you about all of them if I had known you were there.
I think that's really a beautiful poem. And I was wondering what got you thinking about being born before your love was.
Well, no, it was the other way around. I mean, of course.
You being born before she was, yes.
Yes, because she's a few years younger than I am.
Yeah.
My wife. She's not very many years younger than I am, but enough for me to think about that. There were several years when she wasn't around.
There's a really striking image in the poem. You say that you'd seen blood coming through bandages on a hand holding candy. And it's amazing how certain images just stay with you. I mean, do you remember when you actually saw that?
Oh, I do. Yes, I can remember. I must have been about 2 years old, and I was playing with some older girls. I mean, I thought of them as thoroughly grown up. They must have been all of 7 or 8, and I was 2. And one of them got hurt one day. And you know, when there are tiny children around, they always try to hush it up and not let you know what happened.
Right.
And I was very curious. And they lived upstairs, and I remember the silence and after the crying stopped, and then the two girls coming downstairs. I was made to wait down at the bottom of the stairs, one of those old houses down in Florida that had wooden steps coming down the back, you know. And I was supposed to wait down at the bottom. And I waited down there because I wanted to find out what happened. They came down, and there was this bandage with the blood coming through, and they both had new pieces of toffee candy that they were eating to make them feel better. I didn't get any.
Was that a very frightening image to you?
Well, it was curious, you know. There's a sort of Buddhist image of what one's existence in life is, that the pleasure and pain are always mixed, and they talk about, you know, honey on a razor. It's that funny mixture. It's both exciting and frightening and something that one's most drawn to and repelled by, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one last thing about this poem, Being Early, which you just read. It ends with, "I could have told you about all of them, all of these images, if I had known you were there." And, I mean, that's really like the writer's desire, isn't it, to tell?
Yes.
I mean, to tell people
is.
About things. Mm. And I wonder if you can explain your need or your desire to tell, to write, to describe.
If I could explain it, you know, it might go away. It's there all the time. And yet, you know, one, I don't think anybody ever knows exactly who they wanted. Some poems you know that you want to go to one specific person. And sometimes there's a poem in which there's someone, an image over one's shoulder, you know, that you're writing for. But there's always, I think you're always writing for everybody, don't you think? You know, everybody's experience, which they share with you and you share with them, and the experience behind a poem like that is not going to be anybody else's, and yet if it works, they're going to recognize something in their own lives that is the same.
Well, one of the things that interests me about your desire to tell, your desire to describe, is that you come from what you describe as a reticent family, a family of people who really didn't talk very much at all.
Yes, that's true. But that didn't make any difference. I can remember when I was very young listening to music, and I don't even think it was very, very interesting or very good music, but I was trying to explain what was wonderful about the music, and there was no way, there was no way of getting through to anybody. And of course, this is always there. I think there are always two sides to this thing. Finally, it's impossible to say what any experience is like to anybody else. And yet the miraculous thing about literature is that it does say so much it does allow one to, you know, this much misused word now, share. It does allow one to share experience with other people. Literally share it the way you'd share a piece of bread or something like that, you know, when one person has one part of it and the other person has another part of it. And you recognize something that you have in common. And this is, you know, this is one of the really hopeful things about being alive, that one can do that. Can you imagine not being able to do it at all, the terrible isolation?
Sure.
Some people suffer that.
You always describe poetry as using language as a vehicle for the unsayable.
That's it. It is unsayable. And one makes these kind of incursions on the unsayable, but of course the unsayable is infinite. There's no way, finally, of saying it. But we do say the most extraordinarily intimate and true things sometimes, and it's always amazing that we can do it. When you think that language is something that no one of us has made, it's something that we inherit and pick up as we go along, and it's the word for the color red is the word for all of the colors red, and yet when we use it, we're talking about something very specific, and sometimes people can hear it and see something very specific out of their own lives.
You studied poetry with John Berryman at Princeton.
I did.
And you have a poem that I very much like that you wrote about advice that he gave you about poetry. And I'd really like it if you read that poem for us. And this is, my guess is W.S. Merwin, who has a new volume of poems called The Rain in the Trees. But this is an earlier poem that I'm asking you to read now.
It's out of the book that came before The Rain in the Trees, which is Opening the Hand. And it's now in the selected poems, too. And the poem is called Berryman. I will tell you what he told me in the years just after the war, as we then called the Second World War. Don't lose your arrogance yet, he said. You can do that when you're older. Lose it too soon and you may merely replace it with vanity. Just one time, he suggested, changing the usual order of the same words in a line of verse. Why point out a thing twice? He suggested I pray to the muse. Get down on my knees and pray right there in the corner, and he said he meant it, literally. It was in the days before the beard and the drink, but he was deep in tides of his own through which he sailed, chin sideways and head tilted like a tacking sloop. He was far older than the dates allowed for, much older than I was. He was in his 30s. He snapped down his nose with an accent I think he had affected in England. As for publishing, he advised me to paper my wall with rejection slips. His lips and the bones of his long fingers trembled with the vehemence of his views about poetry. He said the great presence that permitted everything and transmuted it in poetry was passion. Passion was genius, and he praised movement and invention. I had hardly begun to read. I asked, how can you ever be sure that what you write is really any good at all? And he said, you can't. You can't. You can never be sure. You die without knowing whether anything you wrote was any good. If you have to be sure, don't write.
Gosh, I like that. At the end, you know, of the poem there, where he gives you that advice that if you have to be sure that your poems are good, don't write. I mean, was that really plaguing you a lot? How do you know if your poems are good?
Oh, no, it was a kind of a great relief. It made me feel that, you know, you couldn't kind of footsie around with it, you know. If you were going to write for the wrong reasons, and I think this is wonderful advice for anybody starting out, you know, if you're going to write for the wrong reasons, you'll reap the results of writing for the wrong reasons. If it's just an ego gratification, or if it's just for money and status and those things, well, you may get those things, but they're never going to be very satisfying.
But, you know, I think a lot of artists are really fueled by self-confidence, that they really believe in their stuff so much. They really believe that it's good.
That's great.
And it's that self-confidence that, you know, enables them to survive different, hard economic times or, you know, other insecurities.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it should never be forgotten. I mean, I see young writers who are very concerned about how big an advance they can get for their first book and the status that it's going to lead them to. And, you know, I understand that, and everything in the society pushes them that way. But I think it's very important to realize that almost anybody that we really admire as we grow up, and if thinking of Van Gogh or Rambo or, you know, Beethoven or anybody, of the really great figures, there were periods in their lives in most cases in which they really had no money, and which the only thing that kept them going was this passion for what they wanted to do. It was Lowell says in Day by Day, in writing about Berryman, he said, "We prayed to be obsessed with writing, and we are." You know, it's a sort of it goes beyond neurosis. That Otto, the psychologist, said that the difference between a neurotic and an artist is that the artist does something with his neurosis.
I like that. You know, I have to tell you, a friend of mine was given the task a long time ago of meeting you on a college campus and taking you to the place where you were to do your reading. And he asked the teacher that was bringing you in, "How will I recognize Merwin?" And the teacher said, "You'll recognize him. He looks like a poet." I wonder how you react to that.
There's no way to react to it because, if people think that, that's what they think. I don't know what a poet looks like. I'm glad if people think so.
Well, did you have an image in your own mind when you were coming of age and deciding to be a poet of what a poet's life was, what a poet looks like, what it means to be a poet, that kind of stuff?
I did. I thought that there were certain things you did not do. I thought it was very important to be independent. And to me, it was very important to maintain certain links with things that meant a great deal to me. One of them was the natural world, and I've always felt that. I mean, I think that I've always felt that I had one foot in the city and one foot in a very unurban place, and I still feel that way. The city for me is history. It's the contact with history. But history is not everything. I mean, history comes out of something which is much larger, and we're trying to destroy it. Well, we aren't going to succeed. We're going to make a terrible mess of things around us, but the natural world will survive us, I think.
Is this why you're living in Hawaii now, to be
one of the reasons,
more around nature?
I love it there. I think it's important for people to try to live in a way they want to live. And, of course, not everybody can do it. I mean, many people really are caught in circumstances that they really feel they can't control. But a young poet that I met recently talked about in a lecture about having asked people in a lecture that she'd given a few months before. She'd asked a lot of people to put all their books aside and just put a piece of paper on the desk and draw for the next 5 minutes the ideal home. I mean, the ideal place where they would like to live. And that they, you know, they could take it out of any part of their lives, out of their past, out of their childhoods, out of the present or anything. And then she said, "All right, now turn the page, paper over, and draw the place where you're living now. And think about the difference." Mm-hmm. I mean, why are you not living where you want to be living? Is it really that you've made so many compromises which may be why you're unhappy with your lives, as many people are?
Well, there's a real short poem I'd like to ask you to read called Witness.
Witness. There are many. The new book is called The Rain in the Trees, and this is one of the trees poems. Witness. I want to tell what the forests were like. I will have to speak in a forgotten language. There's something behind that poem. My feeling that as the kind of imperialism that's built into our situation right now. I mean, I hear that 75% of the world's letters now are being written in English. And what does that mean for the gene pool of language, you know? That as that happens, and our point of view does not broaden, in fact, it narrows. And we think that other cultures really are uninteresting. I mean, that oral cultures somehow are clumsy attempts to really be like us. I mean, that's what they're all trying to do and failing. Along with that goes a growing indifference to the disappearance of other kinds of cultures, other ways of being human, other ways of being in the world. And I think that indifference is part of the destruction of the natural world that's going on around us. I mean, the most appalling example of it now is the continuing destruction of the rainforests all through the tropics of the planet, and the effects of that. I mean, whether people in the cities care about trees or anything like that, we do care about breathing, you know, and our oxygen comes from there.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and hear some more of your poems, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is poet W.S. Merwin, and he has a new collection of poems called The Rain in the Trees, and the poem he just read is from that collection. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Poet W.S. Merwin is my guest. You're just talking about the destruction of the forest. Now, you grew up, in part, in an area of Pennsylvania that has since been strip mined. Has seeing that happen to places where your family lived affected you a lot?
I think that was seeing the first strip mine was a kind of traumatic experience that in some ways I never got over. I just stood there, I remember, as a child of about 10, and tears ran down my face. I couldn't believe that anyone would do a thing like that. And I couldn't believe that there was anything worth doing anything like that for. And this was an area that I had known a few months before as a mountainside. It wasn't primitive, primeval forest, but it was beautiful second growth forest. And it suddenly here was this great gouge in the earth about 100 feet deep and about 300 feet wide with a big steam shovel down the bottom of it and a lot of water with sulfur in it and new erosion lines down the sides of the banks, and that was all that was there. And I, you know, it was a shock that I can remember wandering around the rest of that afternoon in a kind of daze, couldn't believe this. And found out what it was, and in a way, I've never come to terms with it. I think that our ability to do that to the world that we've been given, in a way, is something that we're doing to ourselves, and it's something we're doing to our lives.
I want to ask you something else about your family. You talked before about how your family wasn't a very verbal family. You've described yourself as growing up in a kind of bookless home. If that was so, how did you get interested in reading and in writing?
My mother read to me, you know, and she read very well, and she cared about reading. My father was a minister, a Presbyterian minister, and you'd have thought he read, but he didn't read very much. But I did care about the books that were read to me, and there was one book in particular about Indians that was a book for children to learn to read from, and I taught myself to read out of that book because I wanted to find out about these pictures of these about who these people were in the pictures, you know, and it was a book that began, you know, a man, an Indian man, and so forth. And by the time I got through the book, I learned a tiny bit about Indians and a tiny bit about reading, and was able to go on from there. But it's occurred to me that it's rather strange to have learned to read to find out about an oral people and the way they lived.
An interesting contradiction. Since your parents weren't much, didn't read much, when you started to write, Did you miss the kind of parental approval and appreciation that you might have liked to have? Of well, like, God, first... that's a great poem, William.
Oh, no, I didn't never got that. But I tried to write hymns first, you see. They had the first poems that I knew about were the hymns down in the church, and I was kind of fascinated by those. And I tried to write some more hymns, and I thought my father should at least do me the courtesy of using them in the service.
Which he didn't.
He didn't, no.
After college, you went abroad and tutored in several different countries. Did you start to reinvent your life when you were very far away from your home? Embroider little things, change things around?
Well, I think it began to develop a slightly rosy glow. I got very homesick. I was living on very little money. I worked for the BBC for a number of years.
Oh, doing translations for them?
Doing translations for the third program, in the great days of the third program. And so I could live on very little money in London. And I knew that if I came back, I'd have to get a respectable job and probably teach college or something like that. I didn't want to do that because I saw many of my contemporaries getting caught in a kind of fixed career in which they began to feel that they couldn't live outside it. And I felt very clear that I could live outside it and that I wanted to be footloose and independent, and that seemed to be very important. So I stayed away for 7 years, but I was getting very homesick at the same time.
Many of your poems are about memory and memories. Do you trust yours? And does that matter?
Well, what does that mean? You know, of course, one does not remember exactly what's there, but one doesn't see exactly what's there. One sees what one sees, and one remembers what one remembers, and it is a kind of reality. Nobody sees what's there. You know, if we talk about what we're looking at, we describe two different things, you know. And if we, the farther we get away from it, the more it changes. But what's changing is us. And so, you know, the memory, as long as one doesn't pretend that it's historically accurate, it's accurate in a different way, which is somewhere between historic accuracy and the imagination itself. And one doesn't really, one can control that, but only up to a point.
There's a poem about a memory I'd like for you to read. It's called Waking to the Rain.
Again, the book is called The Rain in the Trees, and there are many trees and much rain. I'm very fond of both of them. Waking to the Rain. The night of my birthday, I woke from a dream of harmony, suddenly hearing an old man, not my father, I said, but it was my father, gasping my name as he fell on the stone steps outside, just under the window, in the rain. I do not know how many times he may have called before I woke. I was lying in my parents' room in the empty house, both of them dead that year, and the rain was falling all around me, the only sound.
Can I ask what did happen that night when
just,
you woke?
Just exactly that.
Was it really a man, or were you dreaming?
Oh, I think it was in that state that you are between dreaming and waking. I think I dreamed it, but I don't know. I mean, after all, I was I was sleeping in my parents' bedroom, and anything could have happened. They had died not very long before that.
Has that happened to you a lot, where you come out of a dream and you think you hear something and you don't know if you did or not?
Oh, not a lot, but fairly often.
Yeah, it's a very interesting state.
Yes.
That's one of the things that interests me in this poem.
Very, very important state. I think you're seeing something. You're seeing something that you don't see in any other state. Dante talks about it, you know, in the Divine Comedy. If you go through it, you find that he makes various transitions by means of various dreams. And there's one place where he talks very, very, very brilliantly, and as always, and very concisely about that state of mind just before one is awake and when one is really asleep, but also partly awake. Another wonderful book on the subject, on that subject, is James Hillman's The Dream in the Underworld, which was published a year or two ago.
No, you were saying a little earlier that when you were younger and went to Europe after college, you really wanted to learn to be independent and not have to have that 9-to-5 kind of job. You've managed to stay alive as a poet, support yourself. How have you supported yourself over the years? You've not taught, right?
Well, I've taught a little bit. I've taught at Cooper Union.
But you haven't been a full-time professor.
No.
Haven't been associated for many years with the university, which is the way many poets have supported themselves.
Well, I did manage to earn a certain amount of money for a number of years by translating. And I think it's important not to have very high standards of how, not to have a very high standard of living. I mean, to be able to live, I mean, it never occurred to me that I was going to make a lot of money, and I haven't. And but it didn't matter. It's never mattered very much, because the things that I did care about, I cared about so much more than that. So I just resigned myself to the fact that it wasn't going to happen. And as long as I could be independent and could you know, pay the bills, and that was all right. And I've had a number of fellowships and grants. If you average them out over the years, they don't amount to very much, but they've come along at intervals that when it was very helpful, you know. That's really how it's been, sort of hand to mouth. But I've been extremely lucky. On the other hand, I think that if you start getting yourself into a very secure but rather rigid situation too early in your life, there may be strokes of luck that come your way that you can't use, you know. My first trip to Europe as a tutor was there purely because I didn't have any particular thing that I had to do, and when the chance to do this one came along, I said, fine, I could take it, you know. And it led to other positions like that.
I would like to ask you to read one final poem before we have to conclude. Now, since I've chosen all of the poems so far, I thought I'd give you the opportunity to choose one you especially would like to read.
Well, what about the first poem in The Rain in the Trees, which is called Late Spring? Coming into the high room again after years, after oceans and shadows of hills and the sounds of lies, after losses and feet on stairs, after looking and mistakes and forgetting, turning there, thinking to find no one except those I knew, finally I saw you, sitting in white, already waiting. You of whom I had heard with my own ears since the beginning, for whom more than once I had opened the door, believing you were not far.
When did you write that? And what were the circumstances behind the writing of it?
I wrote it in New York in the summer of 1982 sometime. The circumstances. Oh, you mean? Well, I was with my wife, and I was thinking about meeting her.
Mm-hmm. You know, in so many of your poems, you seem so surprised to have had to have such a wonderful relationship with one woman. I just seem perpetually surprised in your poems about that.
Oh, I think it's a very surprising thing to be alive, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
And that's the most wonderful thing that can happen, is to have that kind of relation with somebody. I mean, that's the most... So it's the most surprising thing of all.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for reading some of your poems and for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been poet W.S. Merwin. He has a new collection of poems titled The Rain in the Trees. It's just been published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Jim Lehrer. He's the co-anchor of the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. He also writes plays and has a new novel called Kick the Can. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Since the early 70s, William Balcom and Joan Morris have won acclaim for their renditions of American popular song. But now Balcom's own compositions are redefining his position in American music. Coming up, we'll hear from the winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize in Music. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle performs a couple of songs from Annie Get Your Gun. It's part of her continuing tribute to composer Irving Berlin. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews M. Butterfly, the Broadway play that deals with deceptions, political and sexual. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Secretary of State George Shultz today met with NATO allies to discuss his 2 days of talks with Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze. And in Washington, National Security Advisor Colin Powell briefed senators on the agreements reached with the Soviets in Geneva. Both Powell and Shultz said the verification disputes have now been resolved. NPR's Anne Garrels has this report.
After the briefing, the senators all said their initial reaction was positive, but all cautioned they needed time to examine the documents resolving the verification disputes over the weekend. On Monday, the Intelligence, Armed Services, and Foreign Relations Committees will meet to discuss the INF Treaty. Depending on their reports, Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd says the treaty could be sent to the Senate floor immediately. But the resolution of the verification issues does not mean all problems have been solved. Senate Democrats and the administration are still at odds over a proposal attached to the treaty saying the president cannot reinterpret a treaty without Senate approval. And the fiercest treaty opponent of all, Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, says he plans to introduce at least a dozen amendments during the ratification debate. It's not clear if the treaty can be ratified in time for President Reagan to take it with him to Moscow. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
In East Jerusalem today, 10 Palestinians and 3 Israeli policemen were wounded in demonstrations after Friday prayers. Today is the last Friday of Ramadan, the Muslim holy month. More than 3,000 police were stationed in East Jerusalem. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Israeli police charged demonstrators today at Al-Aqsa Mosque after a few hundred chanted political slogans, threw stones, and burned an Israeli flag. According to Israeli radio, the police fired rubber bullets and used batons to beat protesters in a 90-minute battle in Islam's third holiest shrine. This morning in the occupied Gaza Strip, soldiers surrounded the main mosque in the city, preventing young men from entering. Leaflets distributed in Gaza have called for a general strike on Sunday to mark the anniversary of the creation of Israel 40 years ago. In the West Bank town of Hebron, a curfew was ordered at 4 a.m. this morning. The more than 100,000 residents there spent the last Friday of Ramadan in their homes. Most of the occupied territories were closed to the media today. Soldiers stationed at the entrances to Jerusalem stopped cars and turned back many Muslims on their way to Al-Aqsa Mosque. The crowds this year were less than usual. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
Two gunmen who held a police officer hostage for 8 hours in a motel room in Portland, Oregon, were found dead today. It's not known how the two men died, although the police officer who was taken hostage said that as he was making his escape, he began firing and may have wounded the men. The State Department said today the U.S. has begun sending cash to Contra rebels inside Nicaragua. The money, which could total as much as $450,000 in the next month, is being delivered by the Agency for International Development. Spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley says that the money will be used for food and not military supplies.
The money is going to be given in the Nicaraguan currency, the Cordobas. Anybody wanting to purchase something other than these very basic necessities would have a difficult time spending Cordobas outside Nicaragua.
Oakley says the aid does not violate the ceasefire agreement between the rebels and the Sandinista government. The government today reported a 0.4% increase in wholesale prices for April. That's a smaller rise than the month before. About half of the April increase was caused by energy prices. So far this year, the Labor Department's producer price index has risen at a seasonally adjusted rate of 2.9%. Double agent Kim Philby was buried today in Moscow with full military honors. For years, Philby spied for Moscow as a mole inside British intelligence. He was the notorious third man in a ring of upper-class British spies. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today on our weekly performance spot, we continue with our salute to Irving Berlin, who celebrated his 100th birthday this month. This is singer Susanna McCorkle with pianist Ben Aronoff and bassist Chip Jackson.
Irving Berlin wrote many great musicals. I think my personal favorite is Annie Get Your Gun from 1946, which I saw in the movie form, not on Broadway. I loved listening to my mother's show records when I was a little girl. I liked them more than kiddie records because the songs really made me feel. And I think Irving Berlin really got inside the heads of his characters with his songs. I'd like to do two that Annie sang that really made me understand the character of Annie, who was so alien to me, this woman who only liked guns and twirling ropes, and she was very cocky and confident and argumentative and so different from me. I liked dolls and wouldn't wear a cowboy suit I got one Christmas and everything. I couldn't understand her at all. And then I began to feel the way she felt about things. In this first song, she's just carefree, and this her whole world is so simple and so right that she just doesn't need any of the things we think we need, like money and things. Got no diamond, got no pearl, still I think I'm a lucky girl. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Got no mansion, got no yacht, still I'm thankful for what I got. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Sunshine gives me a lovely day. Moonlight gives me the Milky Way. Got no checkbooks, got no banks, still I'd like to express my thanks. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Annie's emotions become stirred, and for the first time she senses what it is to feel love and to feel attraction to a man. So when I sing this song, I try to imagine, how would I feel if now, at my age, I had never had a schoolgirl crush on anybody, I'd never got any Valentines, I'd never written a boy's name over and over again in my notebook, never waited for a man to call me, never had my heart broken, never had a wonderful dinner sitting across a table flirting with each other or walked in the moonlight along a river. If I had never felt any of these things, and suddenly this whole world opened up to me and all my emotions came tumbling out just because of one man who unlocked part of my heart that I didn't even know existed. They say that falling in love is wonderful. It's wonderful. So they say. that's known as romance is wonderful. So wonderful. So they tell me. I can't recall who said it. I know I never read it. I only know they tell me that love is grand and to hold a man in your arms, it's wonderful. So they say.
Singer Susanna McCorkle will continue her tribute to Berlin throughout the month of May. This is Fresh Air. Pianist William Baulkham and singer Joan Morris are among the best-known interpreters of American popular song.
You're my funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine. You make me smile with my
But William Baulkham is also a composer, and until recently, this facet of his musical career hasn't been as widely recognized. This year, William Baulkham was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Music for his composition, 12 New Etudes. Here's the first etude, performed by Marc-André Hamelin.
William Baulkham, congratulations on your Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you.
You know, in my circles, I think you're better known for your popular song music than for your composition. Do you feel vindicated now that you've gotten the Pulitzer, that, you know, people are really listening now to your composition?
Well, they were before. It's just that the whole funny part about it was that people could not believe it was the same William Baulkham who would play ragtime and accompany Joan Morris, his wife, and also wrote all these compositions. Now they do know it's all the same person.
Do you think that your interest in songs and in composition represent two different sides of your nature?
Absolutely not.
Uh-huh.
There was a reason I went right into all of this sort of thing, and it really simply was because I was after sort of the basic DNA molecule of American music in the same kind of way that the French have already had it for several centuries, and the Germans and the Italians and so on, because of a sort of a long tradition which really basically comes from song. The French had, of course, the troubadours, and the Germans had the master singers, and we have our own troubadour and master singer still alive.
Irving Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the new set of etudes that have just been recorded by Marc-André Hamelin. Is there an idea that unites these etudes?
Well, in the very much of the same kind of way as the first set of etudes. This is the second set of etudes I did. These mm-hmm. were all what you might call piano problems, pianist problems for 20th century piano music. And there are certain special technical needs which are quite different from the ones the 19th century might have had. So that was, of course, one of the unifying factors, and they're always annotated at the very beginning of each of the etudes. What are the things to watch out for? Often is enough, there are questions of sonority, use of pedal, also leaps, kinds of things which are, you know, very special to our particular period of piano music.
The eighth etude is called Rag Infernal.
Yeah.
And the description there is lateral hand jumps and stretches, use of practically no pedal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, really, this is an example, I think, of a piece that perfectly unites your composition and your interest in ragtime.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that there's something new that you learn when you combine two ordinarily separate areas like that?
Oh, sure. I've always felt that all of these various styles that we have of a particular time do have a kind of consanguinity and unity. This is something we've always been able to see in retrospect, but we can never see while it's happening. And this is the kind of thing which is normal until the 20th century, in which we were all expected to just do one thing. And I'm just simply, in a way, strangely becoming more traditional than everybody else.
Now, these etudes were written for other pianists. Initially for Paul Jacobs, and then he passed away, and it's recorded now by Marc-André Hamelin. Could you play these yourself? I mean, how come you didn't write them for yourself?
Well, actually, if I wanted to practice them, I could. But life has been so crazy recently, and so much has been going on, that I'm perfectly delighted to give them to another pianist.
You used to say that when you started composing, you worked as if someone were looking over your shoulder. What made you feel that way when...
What happened was that in those years, in the 50s and early 60s, there was a kind of repressiveness around, a kind of international imposition of a kind of a modernism, which really, was nothing really wrong with it in itself. What was wrong was a sort of feeling, as Eugene Kurtz, the composer, put it once. He says, it was as if somebody were looking over your shoulder. You must not use a triad. You must not use an octave. You must not use anything that will remind anyone of past music. And so many of us have made our own kind of rebellions against this. In my case, it was in about the middle 60s where I began to say, this is really ridiculous. I can't continue this way. Besides, already I had started to work in vernacular idioms. That was my salvation, I think.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel more uninhibited now? Is there any longer someone looking over your shoulder, so to speak?
Well, I suppose even in the days when somebody was looking over my shoulder, I was snarling back at them. So I don't think I ever really quite felt repressed. But I do find now that... I am more or less accepted for what people think I am, whereas in the other times it was very possible to put me down categorically because I was involved with things that were not considered kosher.
I want to ask you about your Symphony No. 4. Now, part of that symphony, which has just been recorded by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra with Leonard Slatkin, part of that symphony is your setting for a poem by Rethke.
Yes, Theodor Rethke.
And... in many songs, what makes the lyric really singable is this vernacular ease with which the line can be sung. And I think that a lot of poems are really different in the way they're written. For instance, you know, a Gershwin line, like, they're singing songs of love, but not for me.
Right.
Reads really differently than, among the half-dead trees, I came upon the true ease of myself, as if another man appeared out of the depths of my being.
Right.
I mean, which is a line from the Rethke poem.
Right.
It's a beautiful line, but it's just so, it's much denser in a way than
of course it is.
A Gershwin line.
Well, it's just a different kind of thing. First of all, you're not dealing with the same kind of strophic atmosphere that you would have in the usual popular song. It's a question of the sounds of the words themselves. Will they open up to the scrutiny of being read aloud? And I think you can go through any number of poems today, and you can find some that look very nice in the page and will not sound well, and others which will sound beautiful as they're read. And Rethke always sounds well.
Thank you.
wrote the setting for The Rose for your wife and longtime collaborator, Joan Morris.
That's right.
And do you hear her voice when you're composing the music?
Well, I heard her voice, but I also have no illusions about the fact that other people could do it as well. This is perfectly all right with me. I think it was very important for me, however, to have Joan do it, is because Joan is aware of poetic values and literary values, often to a level that many other singers simply just don't have because of her very strong literary background.
You're used to being a performer. When somebody is playing a composition that you wrote and you're actually sitting in the audience instead of being on stage performing it yourself, are you nervous? What's the difference between the kind of nervousness you experience being in the audience as someone else interprets your music and the kind you might experience when you're on stage playing yourself?
Well, of course, I mean, my wife sits next to me and she says, I die a thousand deaths. I sort of go through all kinds of, I fidget, I move around in my seat. I'm really impossible to sit next to. Sometimes I can sit there with total calm and just watch the person either play it well, or if they're really dreadful, I can just sort of sit there shaking my head, you know, in disbelief as the piece is being destroyed before my ears. But it just depends. I found that it's a lot to do with the first few minutes of how a person is playing the piece. If I have a feeling they have a certain kind of confidence, seem to understand what they're doing, even if they differ from my interpretation, there is a certain amount of tolerance. And I'm very thankful to that.
William Balcombe, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
William Balcombe's new compositions, 12 new piano etudes and Symphony No. 4, have just been released on New World Records. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Jerry.
Well, it's Friday the 13th. Think you'll manage to get the show on the air?
I hope so. We don't have, it's a few more minutes from now, but, you know, anything could happen. In Israel, as a matter of fact, this may be a bad day for a university-based computer system. An anonymous person had threatened to activate a computer virus that this person said that he or she had stuck into the computers. And if he lives out the threat, a massive computer failure could occur. We'll have a report on that. And also about the vaccine the Israelis have come up with to immunize their computers. Also tonight, the Math Whiz Kids.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic at Large Laurie Stone has a review of a play now on Broadway called M. Butterfly. It's about political, psychological, and sexual deceptions.
How can it be true? In the 1960s, a French diplomat stationed in Beijing began a 20-year affair with a woman, who later revealed she was a spy and a man. The diplomat was flabbergasted by both disclosures. How can it be true? That question intrigued David Henry Hwang, the author of FOB and Family Devotions, and the resulting meditation is his latest play, M. Butterfly, now running at the Eugene O'Neill Theater. The piece is loaded with intelligence and spooky beauty. Hwang calls the diplomat Gallimar, he's played by John Lithgow, and makes him a man who's always felt unmasculine. In his mind, he sees a perfect woman, entirely devoted to satisfying men's needs, like a geisha, like Puccini's binge on masochism, Madama Butterfly. Such a creature could make Gallimard lean, mean, and leathery enough to rise to the occasion, any occasion. To conquer the country of woman offers a map to all domains, other races, other nations. He believes secretly burned to be dominated. And he meets her in the flesh, this figure in his brain. She's a performer in the Beijing opera, Song Li Ling, played by B.D. Wong. More than any woman he's known, she understands exactly what a man like him wants, and she seduces him, makes him such a slave of his own imaginings, she can convince him of anything. First, that she's a modest woman. Always the lights must be off, and he can never fully undress her. Second, that she becomes pregnant and bears his child. Third, that the information he passes to her about the U.S.'s mounting involvement in Vietnam is only of interest to her because it's his work. Hwang doesn't penetrate the psychology of this relationship as richly as its politics. We don't feel the two characters as lovers, intimate and alone. We don't feel Liling's side of the attraction until nearly the end. But with cunning and style, Huang does answer the question, how can this man not know his lover was a man? The answer is, he knows and doesn't know. He is so deeply repressed he can keep the truth at bay indefinitely, and in a psyche where repression rules, fantasy runs rampant. It does not matter what sex his lover is, or who, as an individual, his lover is, but rather what gender is represented, what fantasy construction of human parts is offered for delectation. And Huang brilliantly dramatizes how gender works as a bedrock of all fantasies of otherness, how the European imagines all Asian men as feminine, all Asian countries as properly subdued by the white West. The play's minor characters don't add much depth or light, and although Lithgow works hard, he comes off open-faced and blunt, not in the least European or dark around the edges. B.D. Wong, on the other hand, is a marvel, equally credible as both a woman and a man, slippery and sexy all the time. He speaks like a woman by merely changing the register and tempo of his voice, not resorting to falsetto. He creates the proof in the flesh that gender, as Li Ling asserts, is largely a lie of the mind. The physical production is as startling and definitive as Wong's performance. From the no-fat direction to the lights, sound designs, and music, elements that dance with each other and constantly cue moods. The set especially is magic. A long ramp that winds in on itself, a Mobius strip, inside shifting to outside and back, like the psyche itself. Huang, who brings mind and grace to a theater scene starving for these qualities, is only 30. I can't wait to see what he'll do next.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with painter Jacob Lawrence, one of the first black American artists who was recognized by the art establishment. He grew up in Harlem and came of age at the end of the Harlem Renaissance. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review two new albums featuring trumpeter Paul Smoker, and television critic David Bianculli will preview the final two episodes of Saint Elsewhere. The NBC series ends on May 25th. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Carol Jewett. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.